Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust. Hello, everybody, and great to have you back here on ASAP Nowcast. I'm Jeremy Faust. Let's look into ASAP Now in September. Lots to get to here, and I'm an upbeat kind of person. I think you all know that if you know me from here or from life. So talking about the next subject that we're going to start with is never easy, so always a content warning related to suicide. The front page story we did in September was National Physician Suicide Awareness Day, and a really nicely done article by Daniel Lakoff and Lois Swisher. And what Lakoff and Swisher really take us through is, A, the fact that in September, that's the National Physician Suicide Awareness Day, and it's important to think about just as a thing that we confront. But this year was, of course, especially poignant. I think a lot of people saw and heard about the news of an EM physician, Lorna Breen, who died by suicide, and she was a great emergency physician and a friend to so many people. And we've covered a little bit about Lorna in the magazine and also elsewhere in Annals of Emergency Medicine. And so please check out that writing because it's an important thing to think about. Lorna was a, by all accounts, just a machine, just an absolute force of nature. And it's important that we don't think about suicide as a problem that maybe is not an ER problem, not an emergency medicine problem, that somehow we're immune to this. In fact, we're not. And there's a few things that I want to go through that I think are really important. And in addition to the great article that was written, there's also a By the Numbers segment. By the Numbers is in the magazine, as you'll probably know if you see this magazine in print. We have a little section, kind of like USA Today, where we do a data snapshot. And this month, we also did one with physician suicide. And keep in mind that suicide in general is on the rise in the United States, but the relative risk for suicide for physicians versus the general population is increased. It's higher than you'd think. Among females, it's 2.27 times, so 127% more than the average population. And in males, 1.41 times, so 41% greater. That is a big deal. And the next thing I'm going to say is something that surprised me when I read it, is that 50% of suicide decedents did not have a known mental health condition at the time of their death. And I think that is really important to stop and think about because, again, as I mentioned before, it's so easy to think about suicide as a problem that doesn't affect us because if you're listening to this podcast, if you're an ASAP Now reader, you're probably out there functioning really highly and doing great in your career, and you're probably not, you may have mental health problems, many of us do, but you probably wouldn't think that a suicide would be a risk because, oh, you know, mental health, that's a different kettle of fish. We know the patients who come in with suicidal thoughts and just how far along in mental illness some of these patients have to be in order to have pondered suicide, attempted suicide. But in reality, when you hear that statistic that 50% of people who died by suicide did not have a known mental health condition, is that because they hit it and they weren't being treated? Is that because this was really the first sign of that? It's very difficult to say, but what I really want to underscore here is that it creeps up in places that you don't realize. And I've been doing a little bit of work on this. Suicide is actually an impulsive act. Many times it's people who have suicidal thoughts a lot, but then the actual attempt is impulsive, which is why having access to a safe for a gun is a really good idea, which is why the Golden Gate Bridge in California and San Francisco has put up barriers, because it's not just that if you prevent people in the moment from attempting suicide, that they'll just go and do it somewhere else. Actually, that pause, that cool-off period has actually been suggested to decrease rates. So really important. We also want to point out that obviously we're in a very stressed time right now, and so we have now new data showing that essential workers, including emergency physicians, I'm sure, have had an increase in seriously pondering suicide. Not my favorite topic. Really don't love talking about this, but I think it's so important that we do that. And we've written a lot about it. And one comment that I saw somewhere was saying, oh, you know, we can't have a wellness committee and just get out of suicide. We can't just think our way out of this. Because really the reason why emergency physicians and other healthcare professionals are having trouble is that we're being asked to do too much. So how can we say, oh, the solution to physician suicide with respect to emergency medicine is to look out for each other and to have safe spaces and to do these things that, Dr. Lakoff and Dr. Swisher point out, when in fact the root cause behind this is that we're doing a job that's not sustainable? I don't think we have to resolve that. I think the answer is that both things have merit. Yes, it is absolutely true that being put into a difficult situation where you're carrying too many patients at once and you have too many bosses and you have too many things to do, the pressure, that can lead to these exacerbations towards, quite frankly, a suicidal thought or even an attempt. Not downplaying that, but doesn't mean that the things that are out there for this aren't helpful even in that environment. Yes, we want to have a workforce that's sustainable. Yes, we want to have a work environment that is sustainable. But in the meantime, as we do that, we also want to destigmatize this conversation. So be vulnerable to your colleagues, talk about it, just be open, because this is the kind of thing no one needs to suffer in silence, and there's always a resource. So thanks for checking that article out. I did think it was very important to put that on the cover of the magazine, and that is what we did. Let's move on a little bit into the magazine as we open up into the front cover here. News from the college. This is always updates and alerts from ASAP. And in my role, I just tell you, I've learned a lot about what the professional staff at ASAP and also the physician members and in some cases employees do for all of us. So a couple things that struck my viewfinder here. One is the survey results from the financial impact of COVID-19 on group practices and individual physicians. And so this news from the college has really given us what I think a lot of us know, which is the ASAP reimbursement committee looked at a survey to figure out the financial impact of COVID-19, and they got actually quite a number, 197 responses, which when you think about it is a lot, and all shapes and sizes in terms of the practice patterns and all this. And the data that they find really confirmed the anecdotal stories of the impact on emergency medicine practices that has been brought about by COVID. And a lot of real issues, of course, have to do with a lack of reliable PPE supply chains and also decreased volume and revenue. We miss our patients, right? All of a sudden, we realize that the bread and butter medicine that sometimes we don't love doing because some of us would rather be doing maximal ICU care in the ED and those kinds of things. I mean, I love treating the sickest patients, but so sometimes I look at the bread and butter medicine as a little less exciting. But in reality, it's a lot of what we do. And I've embraced that over the years as in the ED, as we're good at it. So we're missing it now because this means that we have fewer patients coming in, and in places that are revenue driven, we don't want to see our physician colleagues who are trained to do this work, who are excellent at this work, and who do essential work, to actually not have enough work. So ASAP is looking into that. The next thing that caught my viewfinder here is get your X waiver through Zoom this fall. Now, I've written in the magazine about the idea of the X waiver for buprenorphine, which is obviously opioid agonist therapy to help our opioid use disorder patients try to be safe. And I'm X waivered, I will say that. But I've also written that I think everyone should be X waivered, and also we should ban the X waiver. There should not be a special need for training for a drug. We all went to medical school. We all trained in residency. We know how to prescribe drugs. Why do we need a special license to prescribe buprenorphine, but not a special license to prescribe fentanyl or opioids in general? So it's kind of weird. So I think we ought to get rid of the X waiver. But until such time as we do that, we all need to be X waivered, because prescribing buprenorphine, getting it started in the emergency department, referring them to a clinic that can kind of pick up the baton, that is the standard of care that is emerging. If you think about the mortality rate on patients that we discharge who had an unintentional overdose from opioids, the one-year mortality on those patients, especially the young ones, is higher than any disease process that we routinely discharge. So we need to realize that these are the lives we can save, and that's what I was writing about a few months ago in my op-ed in ASAP Now. The nice thing about the pandemic, if there's anything, is that we're moving a lot of things online, and ASAP Now is providing, with the provider's clinical support system, a way to get your X waiver, your DEA Data 2000 X waiver for this stuff online, and you can find a session to sign up for at asap.org/ED-X-waiver. And it's in the magazine too, or just Google it. But I looked just now, Tuesdays and Thursdays, a couple options for November, December, and January you could sign up for right now and get X-wavered. And I've done it, and I feel really good about it because I think these are saves. Let's move on a little bit more into the magazine. A couple of things I always like to point out. We've got a great ongoing column called Medico Legal Mind, and this is a back and forth between Eric Funk and Gita Pensa. And Dr. Pensa writes about really preparing for the legal environment, whether it's a deposition or if you've been sued or expert witnesses. And Dr. Funk goes through cases that didn't go well and look at the chart and you think, well, what would I have done better? Where's the mistake? And these are like M&Ms. I think they're great. So always check that out. That's in page 21 of the magazine. Another article that I was really proud to run is an article on page 23 about Black Lives Matter. And this is actually written by Al Jiwa, who is a New York physician. And it's really interesting. Because Dr. Jiwa, in addition to being an associate professor of emergency medicine in New York, he has military training. So he understands what it's like to be in law enforcement and to protect people. He's also Black. And so I think that he really brings an interesting perspective about what this is all about. Because Dr. Jiwa actually sort of said, look, when everything started happening with Black Lives Matter and these kinds of events over the past several years, he was kind of a little bit resistant to buying into the narrative that there was much to be done because maybe the people who were on the receiving end of police violence, maybe they were bad hombres, as he says in the article. But I think he really walks through a turning point philosophically that is really important and that he realized that there is really something to this. And so I think it's really fascinating to read about someone who is walking this path in a very, not neutral way, but you know, he tried to stay neutral and he realized that these things are really, they affect all of us, whether you are an emergency physician or not, whether you are a person of color or not. And I think the way he describes his intellectual journey here is really interesting. And quite frankly, it's inspiring because it just says that there's so many different paths to recognition of a problem and to decide what to do about it. So this is an angle that we are not going to stop covering. We're going to keep covering it. But I thought this was a really impressive and different perspective, one that I had not heard before. Okay, let's move into some bread and butter medicine here. EM Literature of Note, EM Lit of Note, written by Ryan Radecki. And this is a really interesting one on upper GI bleeding and the latest research on when to do endoscopy. This is fascinating. We will have the upper GI bleeding patient, and we, of course, are worried. So we page GI because we want them to have endoscopy right away, please, because we don't want our patient to bleed out and die in our department. Seems legit. So the question is, do we need to actually have urgent or emergent endoscopy for upper GI bleed patients? And this is all based on a trial that was in the New England Journal of Medicine that came out earlier this year. Amazing to think about medicine other than COVID being published in NEJM. It does happen. And this is Lau et al., timing of endoscopy for acute upper gastrointestinal bleeding in the New England Journal of Medicine earlier in 2020. And it's interesting, these are sick patients, by the way. These are folks with the Glasgow-Blatchford bleeding scale of 12 or above. So that's considered high risk. So these are folks who came in, the median enrolled hemoglobin level was 7.4, and some were hypotensive. 90% actually needed RBC transfusion, and some of them, actually the mean requirement was 2.4 units. This is a lot. The exclusion criteria was actually literally hypotensive shock and unstable despite initial resuscitation, which basically the need for a procedure was so urgent that they couldn't randomize them to either get it in a few hours or in many hours. So the other patients, the merely severely but not hypotentially crashing upper GI bleed patients, they were randomized, which is remarkable, to either have an endoscopy within 6 hours or 24 hours. So that's urgent versus early endoscopy. And the patients also got a bunch of things like proton pump inhibitors and other treatments, but the primary outcome of the study was mortality at 30 days. And the interesting thing is the mortality was not significantly different between those groups. So this is kind of interesting. We paged the GI specialist at midnight, 1, 2, 4 in the morning, and we're like, oh, I got a patient who's got a hemoglobin of 7, and they need RBCs, and I need you to get out of bed and come to the department and do an endoscopy right away because this patient is not gonna make it. And it turns out that we can slow our roll. We can slow down a little bit because it turns out there was no real difference in mortality here. We do want to say that there were a handful of patients in the study who did, in each group, rapidly get worse, and those folks therefore got pulled out of the study. So in both groups, in both the early and the urgent group, a few patients had to be immediately taken to the suite. So always keep in mind that, yes, we can always escalate. But this gives us a lot of information. It says we don't have to wake up the GI consult at 2 or 3 in the morning if we haven't actually resuscitated them. I hate it when they're like, yeah, just resuscitate them and we'll see them in the morning. But they actually may have a point. I hate to admit it. And so we'll see if we can adapt to this. So always do the best thing for your patient, but also we don't want to escalate unless it's absolutely necessary to escalate. Let's finish with another evidence-based medicine topic, one that we haven't discussed in quite some time, but I think that it's one that we think about an awful lot, and that is thrombolytics for acute ischemic stroke. And for those of you who remember, oh gosh, 6-8 years ago now, the American College of Emergency Physicians and the American Academy of Neurology came out with a guideline on ischemic stroke that all took place within 3 hours for the patients who are meeting our criteria. This, of course, led to a major revolt among ASAP's ranks. ASAP then rescinded the policy, redid it, and then came out with a level B recommendation that said we should be offering this treatment, but obviously there's risks and benefits. The whole thing is that the studies upon which the case for thrombolytics for stroke is really based on, that the two major or three major studies have really been torn apart, and they're not great. And Ken Milne, in The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, takes us through that literature yet again, but now there has been another reanalysis of one of the studies that is sort of seen as important in justifying these policies. Just want to take you back. Remember that the NINS trial was sort of the 1990s trial that established TPA for acute stroke within that 3-hour window. Keep in mind that there's a lot of skepticism on that one because the balancing of the two groups was not really good. The patients in the placebo arm were sicker at baseline, so there was a concern that's been reanalysis of that if you accounted for that, then maybe there wasn't any signal for TPA helping anybody, so we wouldn't be doing all these stroke codes anyway because the foundation upon which we do this is actually incorrect. The ECAS-3, which is another study that was looked at, this is another major study that has been relied on. And again, ECAS-3 has now been reanalyzed. Same kind of issue. Somehow or other, there was baseline imbalances in the patients who got the thrombolytics versus the ones who did not. And this is in patients getting TPA in the 3 to 4.5 hour window. And it's based on this that many people are offering TPA outside of the 3-hour window, right? That maybe there's a signal that it works for longer, if it works at all. And this reanalysis, which is now in the British Medical Journal's evidence-based medicine imprint, the BMJ evidence-based medicine, went back and looked to see what would happen if you really did adjust for those baseline imbalances in the study population. And lo and behold, no difference in terms of outcomes. They used the modified Rankine score at 90 days. This is an assessment of how well people are doing. Are they independent? Do they need help? Are they still alive? This is the modified Rankine score. And again, with the reanalysis, we see nothing there. So Dr. Mill does conclude that really, if you look at all the studies now, once you take into account the baseline differences in the patients, those studies are really not positive. So it really calls into question our whole approach. Obviously, we are not saying that you should go against your stroke code protocols, but I think moving forward, especially in light of newer studies that are showing that among patients who are appropriate for endovascular clot retrieval, that adding thrombolytics doesn't help those patients. That's a recent study that came out earlier this year. And so maybe we're moving away over time from a fairly failed paradigm of thrombolytics for stroke. Certainly not the case for myocardial infarction. We know that if you can't get a patient to the cardiac catheterization lab, then thrombolytics do have a proven benefit, but that just hasn't really stood up as well in the stroke literature. It's just a real flimsy house of cards there. So that is the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Going to wrap it up for this month. Thanks for listening to ASAP Nowcast. Let me know what you want to hear on the show. Hey, let me know what you want to see in the magazine. I love to get your ideas out there. We have a little bit of a space problem. I wish we could print everything that we get sent, but we always like to get pitched and hear your ideas because really what I'm doing, as you know, is I'm reflecting back what the members on the front lines of emergency medicine are doing, whether it's the front line with the patients or the front line in the politics world where we advocate for our specialty. More than anything, I want the magazine to reflect what it is that you care about, what you're doing to make medicine and your patients better. All right, thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.
ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.